Good day, folks. This is Shane Hasty for the InfoQ Culture Podcast. I'm here with Andrea Goulet and M. Scott Ford. Andrea and Scott are a married couple, and they gave a talk together at QCon New York recently. Andrea, Scott, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Do you want to give us a little bit of an introduction to yourselves and the concept of what you spoke about at QCon, the marriage of communication and code, please?
Yeah. So Scott and I went to high school together and we're really good friends. And we reconnected at our 10-year high school reunion. Scott had a company that he was trying to get off the ground and asked me to come on board and help him with some marketing ideas. And Scott, you said that you had tried running the business by yourself for a little while and you found the marketing side really challenging.
Yeah, I think my strategy was basically if you build it, come. And and just thought, you know, there's so many people on the internet. I only need like a percentage of them to organically find what I've produced and then the money will take care of itself. And I think a very naive way of looking at marketing.
Yeah. So Scott and I kind of caught up the day after the reunion and I said, oh, I understand marketing. I've run businesses since I was 12. You just need to do this and this and this and this and this. And marketing comes about as natural to me as software does to Scott. And then Scott basically offered me half the company, or a little over half. He gave me 51%.
Yeah.
Why did you give me 51%? That was a question we got afterwards.
One, I think to make it clear who was in charge. And two, and just in case we ever wanted to, you know, take advantage of, you know, being a woman-owned business, it seemed like it might be advantageous at some point in time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought there felt like little risk. So we got started and that was in 2009. So it's been, you know, coming up on a decade where we've been working together. And over the course of that, we decided we liked each other enough where we would get married too. And we focus on really, really complex legacy code projects. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to make a lot of traction in large part because we've understood the value of communication. And I say sometimes that had we not fallen in love, we probably would have parted ways as business partners because it's so hard to work with somebody who doesn't see things the way you do. Scott and I approach the world so differently and that has been so frustrating. So the talk really was, you know, here are some of the lessons that we've learned and here are some of the ideas that we've come to. We presented them as communication frameworks, you know, because we use frameworks all the time in code. And that's very much how I see communication. And there are concepts such as Conway's Law that basically mirror, you know, your code is only going to be as good as the communication architecture that you use to uphold it. So the more we started kind of diving into specifically legacy projects, which are inherently complex and have a lot of dependencies, the more we realized that what we really needed to get good at as a consulting firm was communication. Mm-hmm. And that's where I felt like, oh, I can do that. I felt like I had purpose again, rather than just, oh, I'm not technical. I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know why you want me to run this software company. But yeah, so it's been an interesting ride. A lot of fun.
Conway's Law about communication in the office place.
Yeah, Scott, you take that one because you were the one who introduced me to it.
Yeah, I think I was first. My first introduction to Conway's Law was at a talk that I saw Michael Feathers give, where he was exploring it and as a perhaps a root cause for why some software systems are in the state that they're in, and looking at, you know, Conway's Law is a way of saying that, you know, Andre already stated it, but it, you know, it's that you can only do is what the system you produce will only be as good as the communication structure that you have while you're producing it, and you know, kind of trying to see if, like, you know, if that kind of causal relationship might be a way to, you know, something to be aware of when we're working with businesses and organizations, either for, you know, coming from a place of empathy or an understanding that we can fix the technical problem and it'll likely just come back again. If the communication problem that gave rise to it hasn't been addressed, then it will likely reemerge.
Andrea, what are some of the challenges dealing with these people that do communicate so differently?
You know, you've heard forest and tree people. And I think the challenge is that Scott and I are even on opposite ends of the spectrum. So I am more of an Earth person. Like, I see things from an orbit where it's like, I see continents and I see big systems. And Scott is very much a twig person. So he doesn't just see the tree. He sees the twig that's on the branch. And so I think the biggest challenge has just been kind of wrapping our brains around, like, what do you even mean? And that, I think, has taken a really long time for me to understand enough about the software side of things so that I could learn it. But then Scott teaching from a place of, he was teaching someone who was a twig person. And for me, I really needed to see big themes and like big architectural sweeps. And I need to know, like, what is a microservices first before I understand like the syntax of any specific language. And so the learning styles, I think, are incredibly different, which has been a big challenge in trying to teach the other person about our specific skill set.
And I think we've noticed that there seems to be a bias amongst learning materials, you know, educational materials that are out there, and that these seem to cater more towards the learning styles that I have versus the learning styles that Andre has. So not just being tree versus twig, but, you know, do you learn best by reading? Do you learn best by listening? Do you learn best by acting things out? And I feel like, you know, there's a huge swath of material for people who read. There's a growing body of material for people who like to listen or watch. There's still not, you know, not a whole bunch for people who have to do in order to learn. And that's been a challenge as well, is, you know, my strategy was like, well, just do what I did, read a book, you know, and that only translates so far.
Yeah. Especially when the book is written in a way where it's like, I have to understand all these syntax things. Like, I really wanted to understand the big picture overview. But it's ended up being really good for our clients because we get called in a lot for being able to provide now both a really deep technical understanding and the big picture strategic understanding. And so, you know, both executive teams and technical teams enjoy working with us because we can, another term from Michael Feathers is the full spectrum, you know, developer. And I think neither one of us really has that on our own, right? But together, I think now that we have figured out how to work together, the skill set that we have is very broad.
The value of diversity in teams, obviously you're a couple, but there's a lot of diversity there from multiple points of view. But you made a key point, learning how to communicate with each other. What are some of the ways that we can learn how to communicate with each other?
Our principal one was therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the benefits of being a married couple or learning how to be a married couple is we went to therapy. And they taught us, that was actually the first one that we presented, Scott, was the I statements.
Yep.
And learning, and it sounded so pedantic and we both hated it and we both felt like robots. And then it started working.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think any kind of, you know, learning to communicate with each other, like any kind of forced framework like that, especially for, you know, any two business partners who are getting frustrated with sharing their ideas with each other, you know, I think, you know, something similar to therapy or maybe even just therapy would definitely help. There's something really powerful about not necessarily being heard, but feeling like you've been heard. And I feel like that's what we got at least that's what I got the most out of therapy, was feeling like I had been heard and learning how to listen so that Andrea felt like she was heard.
We used that last night when we were debating yes. between which Star Trek is better, Voyager or Next Gen. I am a Next Gen fan.
The outcome of that debate. We should send all of our teams for therapy?
I don't know teams necessarily, but I would say anytime you have like a dual leadership situation, mm-hmm. those, you know, where there's I've heard it, you know, described in some management situations as like a beast with two heads. Mm-hmm. Those two heads need to go to therapy, at least be really, really good communicating with each other and really, really knowing how to speak as a unit and being aware of where, you know, their difficulty communicating with each other is causing dysfunction amongst a larger team. I don't know if it's necessary for the whole team, but I do think if there is like that dual leadership role, that it does need, it is critical for those two people to really, really know how to communicate effectively with each other.
Yeah. And some of the other things that we've noticed are like places where developers can learn to speak the language of business and business people can learn to speak the language of software development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me having, I would say I was a power user of software. I created all sorts of scripts and, you know, Boolean searches for my database when I was in sales and create all these automated drip campaigns, but I never considered myself technical and that was getting in the way. And Scott was very, very encouraging, both in terms of, no, you can learn this, and he was willing to learn business concepts. So how to read a balance sheet or why estimating is so important for, you know, budgeting and for finance. That has really served us because it's given us a chance to learn from each other. Scott mentioned this earlier, but the idea of empathy. And I feel like it's kind of tossed around these days and, you know, people, it's something that has really impacted us. The best definition that I found of empathy is from Indy Young, who wrote the book Practical Empathy, which is basically like a technical manual if you're trying to understand empathy. It's really, really good. But she describes it as a two-part process. The first is exactly what Scott said, which is really listening and gathering inputs and understanding what somebody else is, what their point of view is. And then there's a second step, which is perspective taking. And so once you've gathered the inputs, then you actively look at things and say, well, if I was in that situation and in that context, how would I react and what would I care about and how would things change? So it's not necessarily a feeling state or a mirroring. It's a cognitive exercise. And so for the two of us, we had explored the idea of empathy pretty early on in therapy and kind of before it became a big buzzword. And I think that's something that before people just write it off as a soft skill, I think it's for us been the glue that has kept us together, because it's, no, I genuinely want to understand. And one tangible example of this was one we gave in the talk, which was the idea of I kept interrupting Scott all the time, right? Like typical marketing person, like, hey, Scott, you got a minute? I don't see your headphones in. You know, you got a sec? And then just like I would see his whole face change, his whole body language just get so frustrated. And I couldn't understand why. But I saw a pattern and I saw that like anytime I asked for his input, he would get upset. And so we used this idea of empathy and these frameworks for communication to try to solve a problem, which was, okay, Scott, I can see that you're in a state of flow, but I can't tell from your body language. And there are times during the day where I need your input. And how can we solve this in a way where we can all be happy? And we have been like chewing on this idea for a while. And because we had done all this empathy work, Scott at one point said, Andre, I was so frustrated that time because I was 9 inception layers down when you interrupted me. And it destroyed my whole day. And I lost a lot. Like it was a lot of context to get back up. And I immediately understood. And that was a shortcut for me for empathy. So now we use the idea of inceptions. And so instead of saying, hey, you got a sec, I say inception. And the reason that's a small language tweak, but it's been really profound because, well, Scott, I'll let you describe why, because you're the one who's in it more. I'm in inception way less, but it breaks your flow a lot less.
Yeah, because I just, you know, I just respond with how many levels down I feel I am. So if I'm in a dream within a dream within a dream within a dream, or a mental model within a mental model within a mental model, or, you know, I've come across this come across this chunk of code that I need to understand. Oh, but it calls these 6 other things, so I need to go understand them. But they call these things, so I need to understand them. Oh, now there's this third party library that's getting used. I need to understand that. And there was a bug I was trying to fix in here somewhere. You know, when I get asked, hey, do you got a second? Well, I'm deep in the throes of that. The mental energy it takes for me to figure out that whether or not that's a yes or a no, like whether or not I do actually have a second, because I know it's not a second. I know it's you know, likely 5 to 45 minutes, you know, maybe even longer, you know, for me to answer that question. I'm evaluating all these other things, but like I'm trying to hold all this context in my head and I've only got so much room. And while I'm trying to evaluate, you know, whether or not I have time to even speak, I can just kind of see these ideas that I've been accumulating just start evaporating and dissipating and withering away. But I've noticed that I can, you know, I can very easily say I'm really, really deep. You know, I can say like 5. And then it can be up to Andrea. She now has a way to kind of like evaluate cost. So it could be that she'll say, all right, you're at a 5. I'll come back later. Let me know when you get down to like, you know, below a 2. Or she can say, well, this is really going to suck. This is really important. We have to talk about it. So, you know, you're going to be frustrated, but we have to talk about this.
So this is explicitly calling out one, the cost of the interruption and also the level of interruptibility.
Yeah. And whenever we've given talks like this, we've seen people who have adopted this on their teams and it changes the communication dynamic overnight because that person feels heard, right? Mm. Like, you know, like 7. And then it's like, oh, okay, I'm going to respect you, mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to bug you. Or it's like, you know, you understand the rationale. So it's been a place where we've been able to meet really, really closely in a place that otherwise was just fraught with conflict.
So for a team to implement this, they'd need to sort of agree what a level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 means.
Yeah, I think we set it from like 1 to, I don't know, we usually use 1 to 5. I don't think we generally go above a 5. Sometimes I've seen a 10, like if it's like an exaggerated. But the way that we usually say is like, you know, above a 2 is uninterruptible. Like just, I won't even ask a follow-up question usually. Yeah, and that's kind urgent. Unless it's urgent, yeah. Urgent. Genuine. And we try to minimize the urgency too. I was somebody who was trained to motivate teams through urgency. Mm. And that doesn't work in, you know, software teams. And now that I build software, I understand why. So one of our core values became calm the chaos. And just stating that explicitly, that we don't have to have fires that we have to put out all the time. The goal is to prevent fires. It's not to fight them. And that's just being very explicit about that's the culture. And when I give talks about this, the way that I say that is that the only way that you can prevent fires is through really good communication. Because oftentimes fires emerge because people are making assumptions because they can't find the information. And then that person's not accessible and stress happens. But if you create a lot of retrospective documentation and just say, this is what happened and here's where I am. And, you know, just kind of document your day and then use the inception levels. I think those are kind of the two practices. So we do daily journals. So everybody writes just in a GitHub wiki and just writes about their day. And some days, you know, if you're solving a tough problem, it becomes a long technical thing that then later gets turned into a blog post. And a lot of times it's, oh yeah, Don solved that problem on that client years, you know, a year and a half ago. Let's dig through his journal and see if we can find it. Mm-hmm. And then like, so the way I describe documentation is the prospective documentation around estimating, around predicting, around things like that is useless. Mm-hmm. Like just have a conversation, but retrospective documentation where you're documenting your findings and your learnings and your rationale is priceless. And let other people dig through it, but just write down what you learned and what you went through, and then people will interrupt you much, much, much less.
The concept of a daily journal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that arose from, you know, this idea of, you know, kind of keeping an engineer's journal. I had worked with several social software engineers who had, like, you know, kind of came from more formal engineering backgrounds where they were encouraged to, like, you know, have a notebook at their desk that they kept notes in throughout the day. And then, you know, they would save these, and, you know, sometimes they would be used to kind of harvest what happened when or why certain decisions were made. So to me, it sounded like a blog that you just kind of keep throughout your day. And I had experimented on a few jobs of just like installing a blog engine on my desktop. And then if my manager wanted to know what my progress was. I could just send them a link, and it was my way of like not writing a status report. Because it was like, you know, if you want to know how, if you want to know how it's going, and this was on a project where I was the only developer, if you want to know how it's going, you could, you know, I'll write down how it's going here. You know, you read it, and that way it's asynchronous, and I don't have to lie to you about it, you know, being green, yellow, or red. You know, you can read between the lines and figure that out yourself.
Pull-based status reports.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think around that same time, I had read the book Team of Teams by General McChrystal, and in there, he talked about the communication that happened on the Apollo missions and how when we think of NASA, we think of like lots of bureaucracy and lots of layers, but that actually didn't get implemented until the shuttle program. Mm-hmm. And during the Apollo missions, they had what they called comm loops. So if you wanted to, that you just picked up a phone, and if you wanted to know about, you know, the solar paneling, like you just checked in and you listened in. I was like, oh my God, that's Slack. And they talked about engineering journals and how they would just get passed around. Like we could do that on a wiki. And so part of it was just finding ways to look at what projects have been really successful and how can we model the communication structures that were used to uphold them. And I think we would all agree that, you know, the Apollo space landings were by far a really big success. And, you know, some of the, and those were two things we had just learned about Conway's Law. I was like, well, that was the communication infrastructure. What if we just experimented and tried it? So I think we tried it for a week among the team. And it was like, well, we'll all try keeping a journal for a week. And if we don't like it, then we'll stop doing it. But that was 2 years ago. And everybody still likes it. And literally, like, on our status call today, you know, like, ebbs and flows of business, everything, you know, like, not everybody writes in every bit a day. But this week, like, everybody was really busy, and we were all like, man, I miss the journals. I miss doing my retrospectives. Because it does two things. Three things. First, it helps you shift your short-term thinking into long-term memory. So the act of writing and synthesizing helps you create connections and really learn it in a way where you have to explain it to others. So it helps you change that fast thinking into slow thinking. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that it keeps your managers off your back, right? So I hate nagging. I'm a very kind of more of a laissez-faire. Like I really don't. And I've got a whole product that I'm building around just like not nagging people. But the way that I can do that is if you don't want me to nag you, then this is how not to. Write in your journal and then I'll be good. Right. And then the last is like, it's a good way for camaraderie. Like we work on a completely remote team and this, you know, the combination of Slack and the daily journals really is our office. Like we don't have a water cooler. And so the engineering journals and the daily journals really serve as our like, hey, you know, what'd you work on this weekend? And sometimes people put personal stuff in there like, you know, we have somebody who just bought a house and they were like, this is really stressing me out. And like, we could see that evolution. And rather than just a bullet point in a stand-up, we have more context. And that helps us form deeper connections with the people who are on our team. And then we get more trust and we're willing to ask for help and all of the good things that come from that.
So how long does it take?
10 minutes. Sometimes longer, but sometimes it's a paragraph. Sometimes it's longer.
Yeah, I've experimented with two styles, or I guess three styles. One has been, you know, kind of at the end of my day, writing just a brief summary of my day. Another is in the morning, reflecting on the previous day. And the one I'm currently experimenting with now is just kind of keeping running log throughout the day. And that's the one that feels like it takes up the least amount of time, because it's just like, I have a thought that I don't want to forget later, or I want to keep a record of kind of where I'm at in my journey throughout the day. And so I just jot it down and it doesn't feel like, you know, out of mode to do that. So
and interestingly, because the one you've done those, you've created the most content.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll have like pages of content and I feel like I like those the best as well. Like those are the most, those tend to have the best chance of actually becoming blog posts. And they feel more honest at the end of the day. It feels like a more honest overview of how my day went. Whereas I think I noticed that me personally, I started to kind of, I think apply maybe like the Facebook effect where like I only wanted to share the best parts of my day. I didn't want to share like the things that were frustrating. And I think it's in those frustrations that others can learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that, so making sure I was sharing those frustrations and not just sharing, you know, the highlight reel of like, here's what went great. Like, you know, I walked away from the day feeling like it was awesome. You know, I might still put that in there as like a heading and like kind of say, hey, this is a great day. You know, here are the three projects I worked on. Here's what I did on each one. But those are kind of running things that I have throughout the day. You know, just keep that editor open.
And how much overhead is it for people to extract from that, to explore that?
Well, it depends. So the way that we're set up, I read all the journals, all of them. I consider that my number one job, mm-hmm. is to just kind of get a pulse, because my job as a strategic kind of big sky person, mm-hmm. is to spot patterns. Mm-hmm. And so if I have person A talking about this problem on project Y and person B talking about the same problem over on project Z, then I can start to see the beginning of a pattern and monitor it before it really becomes a problem, and I can solve it systemically. Mm-hmm. With that, and like, I know we had a developer who worked with us who said that I had a knack for solving problems before they even became problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens when I get the good journals. So for me, it's a good amount of overhead. I mean, but reading all the journals, I read really fast. Most executives kind of do, like that's just a big part of your job. Mm-hmm. And you learn to scan and parse. I mean, a lot of people will more read the people who are on their team. So we've got it set up, you know, we've got a team of about 12 people. So we've got it set up so that each client has a lead developer and then at least two understudies. So then that way, you know, read at least the people who are on your team. If you can't read everybody, totally understandable, right? But we do provide some administrative time to pay people for this. And I think that's part of it too, is that I worked for a company once where we were expected to bill 40 hours a week and we weren't allowed to work anymore. And that becomes really stressful, because things like journaling or admin or things like that become challenging, because it's like, well, where am I supposed to do this? Yeah, we make it very explicit. Code. Yeah. So we make it really explicit. I think we budget, like we give everybody 15 minutes a day or half an hour a day for like status updates, retrospectives, like the communication kind of admin that needs to happen, because it's important. And unless you explicitly state that and say, this is an expectation, then it's a little harder for it to get done, we've noticed.
How do you avoid the Facebook effect? Scott, you mentioned it, that we only put the stuff that we want people to see. And yes, I mean, it went wrong, or, you know what, I did insert this bug. How do you create, one, the safety, the trust, and encourage that openness and honesty?
The way we've been doing that is making sure that, you know, Andre and I, when we write in our journals, that we try to keep a focus on that and make sure that we're leading by example there. I feel like Andrea has historically done a much better job at this than I have. Like, I'm the one who's definitely been more of a victim of the, you know, that Facebook effect. I'm a little more open about like personal challenges that might be like kind of interrupting my day. Like, you know, my kid's sick this week, or I've got a really bad cold, or I didn't, you know, for some reason I'm not sleeping well. Even though I might gloss over my technical challenges, I think my life challenges I would still put in there. So I think, you know, that, you know, trying to lead and lead by example and show that those things are okay. And it's important to communicate them.
Yeah. The team definitely takes a lead from, you know, whoever is leading. And so when we write our journals and are very good about it, like the team also follows suit. The other thing we've done is we've paid for everybody to go through empathy training through Brené Brown. She has a class through Courage Works, I think is the name of her website. It's an online class where everybody can learn about what empathy is. And she's got a lot of different kind of tactics in there. So we've picked up some of the vernacular from there. So one example, like on the retrospective this morning, was she uses the idea of a permission slip, right? And we need to give ourselves permission slips. So we need to have self-empathy, which I really struggle with. And so she uses the idea of like, okay, I'm going to write myself a permission slip. I had a cold this week, and so my productivity suffered, and that's okay, right? Like I'm still a good developer. I still provide value to the company. And sometimes just saying that out loud. And so that has been incredibly valuable, because it's given everybody on the team insight into why, into some of the more technical aspects of what empathy is and how to use it in a team environment. And it's written in a way where it's really specific to the workplace. So yeah, we did that about a year ago. So kind of the idea is that once a year we hold the training and anybody who hasn't gone through it will go through it again. That's been really, really valuable. And that makes me think too. So one of the things that I'm starting to do is partner with Indy Young, who wrote the book Practical Empathy. And we're developing a curriculum that's going to start with just a series of webinars that we're really focused on, and we call it Empathy for Engineers. Because the idea is, I've had so many conversations with people like Scott. I was on the podcast Developer on Fire, and Dave Rao said, you know, I'm good with machines, but I'm just not good with people. I'm like, no, these are the same problems. Like, they just, you know, if you look at it in terms of frameworks and things like that. So the idea will be, Indy and I both work very closely with development teams on a regular basis. And a lot of the empathy kind of memes, I think, that are out there sometimes tend to be really broad, and they tend to be really focused for more forest people. And so the goal with empathy for engineers will be really taking all of that research and putting it in a way, like kind of like Scott was saying with software training, you know, like we need to take some of these softer skill, you know, and I don't like using the term soft skills. I sometimes say critical skills, right? Or professional skills, but taking some of these professional skills and packaging them in a way where it makes sense to someone who is working at the twig level on a regular basis. So that's kind of a project that's coming up in the next several months.
And I think, you know, just like you can be effective writing scripts on your computer without, you know, having a CS degree, you don't need to know all the details and ins and outs of, you know, every single bit of empathy to employ it effectively. And so I think, you know, that's kind of the chasm, you know, in some of those professional skills as well. Is, you know, I feel like that's what Andre is trying to say, is that, you know, a lot of these skills aren't packaged for people who just, you just need to use them. They don't really need to know how they work or why they work. They just need to use them.
Or understand the context in which they're using. So a lot of times it's for people, you know, empathy is sometimes packaged in a way where it's like people can naturally access a feeling state. And so there's this understanding, but I run into people who are software developers a lot and they say, that's not a natural thing for me, or that's harder. And it's not even that there's, you know,
or any amount of...
Yeah, it's not that it's an autism spectrum thing or a disability or anything like that. I think it's more cultural conditioning, because this happened with Scott. Like, you had just been told your whole life that you're bad with people. I'm like, no, you're not.
No.
You're really good with people. You're a great communicator. And similar to how Scott, as a life partner and a business partner, has really been so supportive for me and like, no, you can learn how to code. And I was really resistant. And I'm like, no, I can't do it. I'm not smart enough. I think, you know, we've really supported each other in those times when self-doubt creeps in.
I think if the typical engineer really wants to understand imposter syndrome, just ask them how they feel about, you know, public speaking. That's where they can access that you know, part of, you know, that vulnerability.
Yeah. And that was something too, like we started doing, was manufacturing, where we don't use the words technical or non-technical on our team. Mm-hmm. We say, you know, more technical or less technical. So the idea is, like, we're a software company, everyone's technical. That's the baseline, right? There are people who maybe come from a business background or people who have a CS degree. Like, we'll say those kinds of words, but we don't use the words technical or non-technical, because that's a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. And being identified as someone who's non-technical for a really long time, it was so hard to crawl out of the, like, when will I be technical? Mm-hmm. But if you're less technical, it's like, you can always grow into something more. And it depends on the context. So one of the things that we did very intentionally was we said every single developer will have to write a blog and will contribute to the blog in a way of generating that feeling of imposter syndrome, to then be able to create an experience that they could then use for perspective taking when they were pairing with someone who hadn't code or doesn't code on a regular basis, and kind of, it feels a little unnatural and I'm really nervous and people are going to see it. And it's like, yeah, I know how that feels. Like, when you write a blog, it's very similar. So that's been really effective too.
Well, some really interesting stuff here, and thank you very much. But we are starting to run out of time, unfortunately. Andrea and Scott, if people want to find out more, how do they get hold of you?
I'm on Twitter. I can be followed on Twitter. I'm M. Scott Ford, all one word, and then corgibytes.com, our website.
Yep, corgi like the dog, bites like the computer bites, B-Y-T-E-S. And I'm also on Twitter, so Andrea Goulet. I'm on LinkedIn, too, probably equally active on both of those. And we also have a community called Legacy Code Rocks. So we have a podcast where we talk about legacy code. We've done several episodes on empathy and where we talk about some of these different ideas in a lot of depth and also apply a you know, kind of very technical angle to it. And the website for that is legacycode.rocks.
Again, thank you very much. Really appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.